Okay, this is Sarah Milligan with the Kentucky Oral History Commission. I'm in Mount Sterling today doing World War II interviews. Right now I'm interviewing Clarence Crabtree about his World War II experience. And joining us today is his daughter, Martha Payne. Now, my first question, Mr. Crabtree, is when were you born?
I was born March 12th, 1914.
1914. You are 94. That's great. Where were you born?
I was born in Powell County, a little place called Boyne, Kentucky.
Boyne, Kentucky.
B-O-W-E-N. Powell County.
Powell County. Now, what is it that you've done post-war? What is it you did as an occupation?
Well, I was helping my dad on the farm, and after I got out of elementary school. I stayed out of school 2 years, but we did not have a high school in the county.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided I was going to stay out and work. And after 2 years, I decided I needed to go to high school. And I got accepted to Berea College, their normal school. I was going to go there, and about the time I was getting ready to go, Powell County opened up and started a high school, and they did not have a bus, but we caught a ride from anybody that we could, and we walked about 4 miles, my sister and I, and then we rode with somebody that worked in Stanton, where the high school was, and he would go every day. We'd meet him there at the highway. That was the only paved road in the county.
So you did go to Powell County High School, and, after all?
After all, I went to Powell County High School, and shortly after we had enrolled, I guess within a month, the person we were riding with had a wreck. Had an old T-model Ford, and he turned it over near a little town called Roslyn,
mm-hmm.
between Boyne and Stanton. And none of us, luckily, my sister and I and two friends, there's four of us riding with this man, and he had a flat tire and went out of control and turned the car over. And one of my friends was under the car. We had to get some help to lift the car off of him, turn it over, and he didn't have a scratch. None of us.
None of you.
But the word got around at school, and the board members decided they needed to buy a new school bus. We didn't have a school bus, and that helped.
Because of your accident.
Helped the board to go ahead and buy a school bus.
Well, that's fortunate that nobody was hurt, but lucky that
that's
they
right.
took the advantage after that. So you went to Powell County High School. So how old were you? Well, first of all, when did you join the, were you in the Army?
I was in the Army Air Forces. And after, well, to make the long story short, I went to Moorhead for 2 years after I got out of high school,
mm-hmm.
and qualified for a teacher's certificate. And I got a job in a one-room school and taught there for 2 years. And then I got a job. I was moved into the central office. Got a promotion, really. I was director of pupil personnel. We called it the attendance officer then.
Where was the central office located?
In Stanton.
In Stanton?
In the courthouse. And so that's what I was doing when I went in service. And I just bought a new car in June. Then Pearl Harbor came along, and there's four friends and I decided to enlist right after Pearl Harbor. And so I drove the five of us. We went through Fort Thomas, Kentucky. That was the closest place that we could enroll, enlist. And
how far away was that from Stanton?
About 100 miles. It's near Cincinnati. Actually, across the river and a little bit south of Cincinnati. And it was an old Army Air Base, and they were real busy taking in recruits. And the four of us went, and they wanted us to come back at a later date. And so they gave us a date. We'd come back January the 14th and be sworn in. In other words, complete your enlistment papers. So we went back home, and one of my best friend out of that group of five of us had applied for a job in a defense factory in Norwood, Ohio, near Cincinnati. They were making Jeeps and military equipment. And so he had applied for a job, and he didn't go with us. And when we went back the second time, just the four of us went. And in the meantime, he checked his local draft board, and he got a deferment. So they gave him a deferment for 1 year. And he decided not to go with the four of us to enlist on January 12th. And there's a little story there. We got separated. Each one of us went to a different desk, and there was a sergeant that took care of filling out the applications, everything, and we got separated. And I had a choice of two places to go. I could go to Fort Wayne, Indiana, where they were opening up a new Army Air Base, or Biloxi, Mississippi. And it was a real cold day, and I decided I'd rather go to Biloxi, Mississippi.
I never knew that.
And they had a base right on the ocean there, Biloxi, Mississippi. And the four of us got back together after we had been with the sergeant filling out our papers, and each one was asking, where did you sign up for? All three of the others, buddies, signed up for Fort Wayne.
Oh, no.
And I had signed up for Biloxi. So I went back and found the sergeant that filled out my papers and asked him to change it, that I had some buddies that were going to Fort Wayne. So he changed it to Bear Field, Fort Wayne, Indiana. It's a new Army Air Base. In fact, they were just building new headquarters, and that's where I ended up working.
What were some of the feelings you experienced that made you want to immediately go to the draft board?
Well, we figured that all four of us were the right age to be drafted, and would have been, and we felt it would be better to go ahead and enlist. So that's what we did. So we got all of our papers taken care of on January the 12th, and we were supposed to report the next day then at the Union Station in Cincinnati to go to Fort Wayne. So we got the bus out of Powell County, rode a Greyhound bus up there, and all of us got on the slow train. Took several hours it stopped at every little town between Cincinnati and Fort Wayne.
Did you pick up a lot of other people who had just enlisted on that train?
There were several Army personnel. We had a good long train trip.
And you had to leave your brand new car.
I had to leave my car at home, and I left it with my sister. She was a teacher. And incidentally, I'd pretty well worn the tires off of it the first 6 months that I had it. And so you couldn't get tires during the war. All you could get was what we call retreads. And there was a place in Fort Wayne that they made the retread tires. And I ended up having to buy some retreads, and I went through the rest of the war on retread tires. You're supposed to drive not more than 35 miles an hour.
You put retread tires on your car?
And I put retread tires
on. Did you go back and get it?
And, well, I didn't go back and get it until I wasn't allowed to have a car while I was a private. After I got to be a non-commissioned officer, after I got to be a sergeant, I could have my own car.
Well, tell me about Fort Wayne. Let's back up. How was your experience when you got to Fort Wayne? What did you feel? Were you excited? Were you nervous?
No, not really. We enjoyed Fort Wayne. It was a nice town, and the air base was about 5 or 6 miles out from Fort Wayne. And I ended up having what we call a permanent pass. Anytime I was off duty, I could go in town. And
how did you get that?
There was a bus that ran out to the air base about every hour, so you could catch a bus into town mm-hmm. and back.
Did everyone have a permanent pass?
No, just a few had the permanent pass.
How did you get the permanent pass?
Well, I was working in base headquarters, and I was, after been there a few months, I became a corporal, and I didn't get a permanent pass till I got to be a sergeant, staff sergeant. And I was one of the few, in fact, I was the only one in our barracks. There were about, I guess, 30 or 40 men lived in the same barracks, had bunks all the way down on each side. And they had about four rooms on the end, and they were the non-commissioned officers, so I was able to live in one of the private rooms. And
how did you move up so fast? Was it because you came in with an education?
Well, the group that I went in with, I was the only one that had some college. And I had 2 years, a little more than 2 years of college. And that's what kept me from going overseas. I wanted to go. After we had our basic training, all four of us took our basic training there at Bear Field. And we were doing KP, guard duty, things like that, when we were in our spare time. And we were getting bored with it. And I had a chance to go to officer school, could have gotten a commission, but I turned it down. I didn't want to leave my buddies. Within a couple of weeks after that, all three of them were shipped out, and they were sent to England, London, England. And I wanted to go. I went to the colonel, who was in charge of the base commander. Tried to get on the list to go. He said, "We need you. We just opened up a new base headquarters. We need you. What you're doing, can't replace you right now." And so I was in charge of all the files. Incidentally, we were writing orders on groups that were going overseas. We were the 45th Air Base there, and then suddenly they changed to be an overseas staging area. And they were processing groups that were scheduled to go overseas. And so I was working in the base headquarters, and we were writing orders. Every group that came through had to have special orders, they called them. And we did not have computers or even a printer back those days. It didn't happen. And it was a very crude way that we had to write the orders. We had about three typists, girls from Fort Wayne, that came out every day, and they cut stencils. If you ever remember seeing those. And then we'd take those stencils and run them off on the mimeograph machine. That's the way we made our copies. And every group that came through, each person in the group had to have a copy of the orders. And every day we were operating that mimeograph machine. And I had one boy that worked with me in the office. All he did was operate the mimeograph machine. His name was Paul Bonecutter, and he was real good at it. You had to put an ink in the machine, and it was one of those that you turn the crank, mm-hmm. and it cranked out the copies.
Was it ever hard for you to be the one that processed a lot of those orders? Did you ever see names you recognized, or?
I can't recall ever seeing anybody that I recognized. They were coming from all over different states. Groups were coming through. We had everything that we needed to process them and get them ready to go. We had a quartermaster corps there that provided the clothes that they would need and equipment. And then we had two large airplane hangars where our mechanics checked out the planes and serviced them. And so we had everything we needed to process each group that came through.
So on a
Even though some of it was crude,
yeah.
we well, managed to.
Did they choose the mimeograph machine coordinator because of his name? Is that how he got the job? The bone cutter?
No, he was a civilian. He wasn't even a military person.
I see.
But he lived outside the base. He lived somewhere in Fort Wayne. And he came out every day. And he was real good at what he did. I was in charge of it. I had to see that it was done. And mainly I was in charge of the complete files. We had, I guess, 8 or 10 big file cabinets, and we had to keep track of everything that went through there. Every letter that came through, we had to have a copy of it.
So on a typical day, what did you do? Can you remember, like, when you wake up and you go out, and what is it you do?
Well, we had regular hours. We'd wake up, we'd hear the bugle in the morning called Reveille. We had to get up for that and go out and exercise before breakfast. And then they had good food, good cooks, mess sergeant that took care of the food. About 8 o'clock, we'd go to work. We had regular hours, mm-hmm. from 8 to 5.
Did you keep up with your friends in London? The three friends that.
Well, somewhat. I would hear the people back home would get letters from them, and through my family, I would indirectly. I would kind of keep track of them. All three of them spent the rest of the time in service, well, the war was over overseas, and they all came back. Neither one of them got hurt, didn't get a scratch. But I wanted to back up a minute and tell you about the friend, best friend of mine that didn't go with us. He was drafted 2 years later.
What year would that be?
About 19, well, we went in 1942, early 44, I would say. But he took his training at Fort Knox, Kentucky, and he trained to be a operator, tank operator. And he was in the battle, got killed in the Battle of the Bulge.
Who was that, Daddy? And
Isaac Rogers.
Oh, okay.
In 1944, December 44. It was one of the last battles that Germany was involved in. And he got killed.
So he hadn't been in the military that long.
No, hadn't been in long. And had he gone with us, he would probably come back safely. See, the four of us did, and he was the only one that didn't, that remained, stayed there and was drafted.
How did you find out about that?
I found out through a relative of mine that I worked with. Actually, my county superintendent that I worked very closely with, and when I was director of pupil personnel, sent me a letter and was telling me about my best buddy getting killed.
Did you receive much information about what was going on abroad and in some of the battles abroad?
Yes, of course. We kept up on the news. We had a newspaper, had access to daily newspaper there in the office every day.
But outside of the general media, did you receive reports or anything about specific battles or specific movements?
Not a whole lot. But we tried to keep up on current events. And I met my present wife there after I'd been there, actually October 42, I'd been there a little less than a year. And she came out, she was in the USO, you know what that is? It's a service organization.
Mm-hmm.
And they would come out to entertain the soldiers, the Army personnel. And we had a good band there, but every so often they would schedule a dance. And the girls in this USO came out to the Army Air Base every so often. And so that's where I met my wife, at the dance. I cut in on her. She was dancing with somebody else.
Did you know her before you cut in on her?
No, I never knew her. Somehow I managed to get her phone number, and I didn't call her for about 3 weeks. I was dating a girl back home too, so I broke up with her, and then I called her Rosemary, and she was surprised that I'd call back, and so we dated the rest of the time I was in service. After I got in the car up there, I was able to go to town anytime I was off duty. Just about, I was almost like a civilian working on the base. But I had the car there. Like I say, I bought some retread tires. The biggest problem was getting gas. See, I had a ration card, had an A card, they called them. I could only get about 20 gallons of gas a month. Maybe it was 30. But getting gas was a big problem. And my girlfriend's dad lived down on a farm about 6 miles out of Fort Wayne. And I went out there, the first time I went out, I drove out there in the car, and she said, well, she said, my boyfriend could use some gas. She said, her dad said, do you suppose this tractor gas would work in his car? And I said, I'm willing to give it a try. So he filled my car up with gas.
The first time you met him?
Yeah, first time I met him.
You must have made an impression on him.
Made a good impression, I guess. But I went on through I was right popular because I had the only car any of the guys in my barracks. And they'd catch a ride with me about any time I was going into town. I had somebody that wanted to ride.
So what did you do in your spare time? What did you do when you went into town?
Actually, we visited a lot of beer joints and things like that, entertainment places.
Were there a lot of those in Fort Wayne?
A lot of them.
A lot of servicemen hanging out at them?
Hanging out, yes.
You went to Chicago, too, a lot, didn't you, Daddy?
I had a brother that was in the Navy. He was going to school. They sent him to school in Chicago, and we went up there, and Rosenberg went with me, and we visited him in Chicago.
And her dad was okay with you taking her to Chicago?
Yes, she was working in town. She had a job in town. She'd been through business college, and she was working for some book company.
How old were you when you went to Fort Wayne?
I was much older than average because I stayed out of school 2 years between elementary school and high school, and stayed out 1 year after I got out of high school before I got a scholarship at Moorhead. Mm-hmm. I was 27.
What is? Would you have been drafted, do you think, at 27?
I would, but they were, in fact, everybody had to register. I still have my registration card. Everybody between 18 and 30, about 18-35, had to register with the draft board. And I would have eventually been drafted. I wouldn't have been one of the first because of my age, but I would have been drafted. So I think I did the right thing by enlisting.
Well, it sounds like you had a good experience. I mean,
I did.
You served a purpose, but you also...
And I like to feel like I did something to help the war effort, even though when I went in, I fully expected to go overseas and be engaged in combat.
Was that a scary thought?
Not really at that time. But after I'd stayed there a while and all my buddies left, I enjoyed being in Fort Wayne and having the privilege of going to town when I wanted to. And
being the most popular guy on campus with a car.
Well, I wasn't that, but it was a good experience, and I felt that I did contribute something to the war effort.
Right. Right. So I'm trying to think. I wanted to ask a question mainly for your daughter about when you were courting your wife. Is that your mother?
Yes.
That's right. We had four children, and all of them are graduates of the University of Kentucky.
So you brought her back to Kentucky?
Right. We came back. And the first time I brought her back, of course, I was still in service. And getting back to those retread tires, it was about 300-mile trip to where my parents lived in Powell County. And it took us 10 hours to drive from Fort Wayne to Powell County.
Wow.
On those driving 35 miles an hour, we made some stops mostly at night. We had to stop and get coffee in order to stay awake.
Did she help you drive?
No, she didn't drive at that time.
It's a long trip.
It was.
So tell me about when the war ended. Do you remember that?
Yes, of course, first when Germany was defeated, VE Day came in May the 8th, I believe, in 1945, and we felt like then that it was pretty well over, but Japan still held on. I think it was August, wasn't it, the VJ Day? But that was a happy day for us.
Do you remember what some of the people were saying? Were there parades, or were people just excited?
They were just excited. And when they announced that the war was over, I went in town that afternoon after I got off work. And my girlfriend met me at the door and said, "The war is over."
Is that how you found out?
And I didn't know any of the details till I talked to her. She said they just announced that the war is over.
She heard it on the radio.
She'd heard it on the radio. Yeah. And people were all around in town. They were blowing their horns on the cars. Cars were blowing, ringing bells. And it was an exciting time.
That's good. How long did you stay in Fort Wayne after that?
I came home almost immediately, and I went back 2 weeks and married my wife.
In Fort Wayne?
In 2 weeks after we got out. Got out the 27th of November, 45, and we got married December 15th,
45. 1945, oh, wow. And then had some baby boomer kids.
We've been celebrating December 15th ever since.
Well, it's a strange when you think about it, because it all started with December 7th. You know, that whole part of your life took you there.
That's right.
Because of December 7th.
And had I not gone to Fort Wayne, if I'd gone to Biloxi, Mississippi, I'd probably never have met my wife.
That's true. So when you went back to Powell County, I guess, is that correct?
Yes.
Did your friends that were sent abroad that enlisted with you, did they come back too?
All of them came back around the same time.
Did you?
Shortly after.
Did you spend a lot of time talking with them about their experiences too?
Yes, I had occasion to talk with them quite often. They lived for several years after they got back, but they're all dead now.
What did they think about you were the only one that stayed in the U.S.? Did they ever say?
No, they knew that I wanted to go with them. But I thought that was a bit of luck that all four of us came back safe.
Very. You don't hear that very often.
That's right.
That's absolutely true. I think but it...
I enrolled shortly after I came back. I enrolled at the University of Kentucky, and I had some little more than 2 years college. I'd taken 2 years before I started teaching in a one-room school, and I taught there 2 years, and then I would go back second semester. I'd go back to school. Our one-room school was only lasted 7 months at that time, and we had a chance to go back and go to school the second semester after the girls.
Yeah.
One-room school was out. And so I had a little more than 2 years of college. And I enrolled in college and decided to major in agriculture, because I had several agriculture classes, and took me about 3 semesters, about a year and a half to finish up at UK. I had a degree in agriculture, and I got a job immediately teaching vocational agriculture down in Hardin County. Mm-hmm. And then I had a chance to, after being there 2 years, a friend of mine that I was in Moorhead with before I went into service was at Camargo. You ever hear of Camargo? It's in Montgomery County.
It's here. It's
and said,
what is it?
We need another teacher.
Incidentally,
all the high schools were taking care of the veterans. That everybody that wanted to farm had a chance to go back to school. And
if you were a veteran.
If you were a veteran. And they paid them to go to the county high school and take a course in vocational agriculture. And we had over 100 veterans in Montgomery County at Camargo. It's the only school that had agriculture.
So did you teach there?
And I taught there. I started out teaching a class of veterans in one high school class. And a guy by the name of Frank Buck was the head teacher. And he and I had been friends in Moorhead before I went in service. And he called me at Rineyville, a little town in Hardin County. Mm-hmm. And said, we need another ag teacher. So I was happy to go back. That's my joining county. I lived in Powell County.
So have you been here ever since?
I've been here ever since. Came here in 1949. As an agriculture teacher. And after I taught veterans 1 year, Frank Buck, the head teacher, decided to go back and get his doctorate degree. And so he went back to UK, and I became head teacher. And from there on, it's history.
It's such an interesting program that you ended up in. They were,
yes.
How did that work? Well, first of all, was it comfortable for you to be the one that were teaching the veterans of the same war the information they needed to get essentially free land? Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
How did that program work? Was it just in Montgomery County?
It worked all right, but we had 5 teachers. Actually, 4 at first, and then when I became head teacher in a high school classes, we had to get another veteran teacher. So we had 5 teachers there that were teaching veterans.
Do you think that
they wouldn't let them have more than 25 per class.
Mm-hmm.
And we had those for. Kept it for several years till eventually they got their time in and we ran out of veterans. And Bill Pauley was the one that stayed the longest, you know.
Yeah,
Mr. Pauley. He stayed there till the program was over.
Did a lot of veterans move to Montgomery County because of that?
No, all counties had it.
Oh.
All counties that had veterans that wanted to farm. Every county that had a ag department, and I think about every county in the state had ag departments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's interesting. So what did you do after all the veterans were cycled through? Did you stayed on and taught?
I stayed on and taught agriculture.
Agriculture. Mm-hmm.
And eventually, shall I tell her about the Chenault?
Sure.
An old gentleman that was a banker in Mount Sterling. He owned something over 1,000-acre farm. His farm was in Bath County, adjoining county, but he worked in Mount Sterling. And he made a lot of money in the stock market. And also he made a lot of money. He had a lot of tobacco, had a big tobacco base, something over 100 acres, and he had about five farm tenants on his farm that raised the tobacco. Yeah. They helped him make a lot of his money, and he put it in the stock market, and he made a lot of, made a bundle of money. And before he died, he made a will, made two wills, made one to Montgomery County, Boag Department, and one to Bath County. And each of us, each school got about $1.3 million.
Wow. When was that?
For Bag facilities. And that was back in the 70s that it became available after he, about 1974. And so that money became available. It was for building facilities and buildings, whatever was needed for a good agriculture program in each of those schools. He was so grateful for what the farmers had done for him, helped him make that money in tobacco, that he wanted to do something for the farmers. And so that is still ongoing. We're still, and we weren't allowed to spend anything but the interest off of that money. And so we were living off the interest and making the improvements. And we got new facilities, a new agriculture building. And incidentally, I switched to my last 5 years I taught horticulture. They built us two new modern greenhouses with some of that Chenault money.
Yeah.
And so I enjoyed my last 5 years, I guess, more than any of the years teaching.
That's really fortunate. When did you retire?
I retired in 1980.
Mm-hmm. What have you been doing since?
Since then, I own two farms. I've been farming part-time, just enjoying life.
That's great. Does your family help you farm?
Yes. Like I say, I send all four of them to University of Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And two of them live here in the county. Martha is one of my best helpers. She does an awful, she and her son, her husband Darren, do an awful lot for us. And my oldest son lives here in the county. And Martha and Darren are interested in flowers and horticulture, and that's was what I was doing when I got out of teaching. And they've helped me establish some perennial flower beds and put out new trees, all that. I just moved to a new home out in Silver Creek. In August 1st, wasn't it?
Looking back, sitting at Fort Wayne in the 40s, could you imagine projecting your life forward that this is where you would be?
No way.
It's so interesting.
But we're still unpacking. We moved in August. I still have an unfinished basement. It's just jammed full of boxes. I haven't unpacked yet. And incidentally, Martha and I, we had an attic full of junk, I call it. And we worked for how long?
We spent a week in the attic.
A week alone in the attic. And then in the garage, I built a new garage where I lived at that time. And there was a lot of things in the garage. We took about five pickup truck loads to the dump. Just junk. My wife says, I never throw anything away. And so
we kept a lot of good stuff, Daddy.
Martha's been one of the best helpers that you can imagine. She and I got rid of a lot of junk, didn't we?
But kept some good stuff, too.
You need that. Yeah, we all need a Martha.
Everybody needs a Martha.
Yeah.
Now we're enjoying. She and her husband helping me a lot in landscaping.
That's great that you've fallen into those footsteps,
right,
with that.
Yeah.
Do you have any questions that you want to ask your dad about?
Incidentally, she built a new house out on her one of my farms. Mm-hmm. I bought this farm in 72. I only had 16 acres. That's where I lived when my kids were growing up. In 1972, I bought this 127-acre farm out on Highway 713. I call it Spencer Road. And Martha, after she got married, she lived in the old house. It had an old tenant house on it. They lived there for a while, and she and Darren built a new modern home out there.
What do you farm on your farms?
Mostly beef cattle.
Cattle
and
farms.
Of course, we had tobacco, but they had the tobacco buy out, and we don't raise tobacco anymore.
Mm-hmm. Cattle farm. Is there anything that you want to ask about?
Oh, you know, Daddy, I think that they've called your generation the greatest generation because you've seen so much.
Right.
And, you know, I just think back on the memories that you and Mommy must have had since, I mean, you remember when there wasn't electricity or you first airplanes and whatever. And looking back on this whole century, I think your generation is the best generation to have witnessed all that, you know. And I just wondered, what was the best time of this whole century for you? Or would there be a time that you would go back to? Or,
well, I wouldn't want to go back to some of those crude ways of living like we had without electricity. Mm-hmm. But I think probably the last years I've enjoyed most.
Your retirement years.
But I remember, like you say, I remember seeing my first airplane.
Where were you?
I was going to school in a one-room school. I was about the fourth or fifth grade, I guess. And the first plane that ever came over that we recognized, didn't know what an airplane was. And the teacher said, "That's an airplane." We all went outside. She dismissed the class to go outside and watch the first plane go over.
Wow.
I remember my first ride in an automobile. We didn't have a paved road through Powell County. It had a gravel, well, it wasn't even gravel, it was a dirt road. And people started buying these old T-model Fords. Riding in one. But I've seen a lot of changes in my 94 years.
I would guess so. I would guess so. Do you expect any changes in the future? If you could think all the things that you've witnessed changing, do you still see that you're going to witness more?
Pardon, I didn't get there.
Do you feel like out of all the things you've witnessed, these huge changes, electricity, cars, planes, can you imagine that there's anything that's going to happen that could top those?
No, there probably will be, but there were some big changes.
Space travel. That's going to be the next. Space travel.
Yes.
Do you have anything else, Martha? That's a good question.
Well, I'm amazed. My mom and dad, they're so rooted in the past, and they have such good ideals that they've taught us and that we've grown up with. But they even wanted to get a computer. So, you know, here we are, we've got a 90-year-old and he's gonna be 94 next month, and they didn't want the world to pass them by, so they got a computer several years ago, and they get on the internet and they know how to do all that stuff. So,
well,
I think it's really, really neat that they're firmly planted in the here and now too.
1993 we got our first one, so it's been several years.
1993.
We're on our second computer.
Not many 94-year-olds can say that.
But My wife likes to invest. She's got some investments, and we both enjoy that. We print out our portfolio about every day or so.
Well, it sounds like you've had a very good life.
I think we do right well for our age. Incidentally, she just turned 90. Had a birthday in January 15th.
That's amazing. You've been married a very long time.
62 years.
62 years.
And they still stay very active, and I think that's what keeps you and Mama young. They still talk about what they're going to do when they get old. And they're active in their church. They go to the Historical Society meetings. You go to the cattlemen's meetings. You go to the retired teacher meetings, and they're just, their calendar is so full and booked. It's really fun to watch.
That's what keeps us going. We're trying to stay active.
It's amazing. I'm thinking back to you talking about meeting her and at the dance, you know, the first day. You can still remember cutting in.
Yes.
62 years later, 63 years later. It's amazing. Well, I'm really glad that you came in today. I think it's an interesting story. I'm glad. I know your daughter's glad too. I can see her smiling.
What is your last name? You're Sarah?
Milligan.
Milligan.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah, it's been nice to meet you. And